I like to think about visible diversity and non-visible diversity. And if you're not visibly diverse, you face quite a lot of similar challenges to other people who are not visibly diverse.
Hi everyone, welcome to a new episode of E-Loopen, the podcast that gives you inspiration and knowledge so that you can stay in the loop at work. My name is Dana Tekia. Today we're going to talk about a topic that's dear and close to my heart, diversity and inclusion. In the studio, I'm lucky to be joined by two brilliant guests, Will Smith and Umair Shamsi. Let's have an introduction. Umair, do you want to go ahead?
Sure. Thanks, Dana, for having me over here, and very good to meet you, Will, as well. I'm Umair, and I am responsible for our people processes in Telenor. And at the same time, I'm really passionate about this topic of diversity inclusion, which is something that I started working when I moved to Norway some 8.5 years ago. But just in terms of a brief introduction, because it's always a loaded question, as we were just talking before the podcast as well, who are you? I think that question is becoming increasingly difficult for me to answer as well, because I've lived half of my life outside of the hometown in Pakistan where I grew up. So I've spent about close to 9 years in the United States and about the same amount of time in Norway. So I'm not sure, but I know that at least Norway is home, and Pakistan is where I go to visit my dad. And I've been in Telenor for more than 12 years. So.
Great to have you. Thank you for coming.
Thanks.
Will?
Thanks for having me.
So thank you again also for me for having me here. It's an absolute pleasure to be here and to see you in person. So I'm Will Smith, not the Will Smith that everybody will be thinking about. Sorry to disappoint, but my role within Deloitte is I am our managing partner for people and purpose across our North and South European business, which really means responsibility for a number of strategic projects that relate to our people and to delivering our purpose across 28 different countries, about 75,000 different people, which is slightly daunting when you think about it in that sense, but actually it's something that I get immense pleasure. And like Umair, it's something that is very close to my heart. I'm very passionate about whether that's diversity, equity, and inclusion, or whether that's just the experience of our people or how we demonstrate the work that we do makes an impact. In terms of who I am, I'm so many different things. And that's what I love about some of this conversation. So I'm based in the UK. I actually grew up in the north of Wales, which is that little country stuck to the side of England. I, along with my husband, I am the caregiver to two little puppy dogs, which bring me a lot of pleasure in my life. I'm an accountant. I work with clients as well as my people responsibilities. And I'm somebody who just loves what he does.
Love it. And that's a great segue into today's topic, because we initially, when we were planning this episode, we were talking, okay, in regards of this theme, what can we talk about in your roles and the work that you do? And so we quickly ended up on the topic of diversity. But when coming into diversity and inclusion, we talked about, you know, what are the topics that we can, that are new or that adds to the conversation or needs to be emphasized? And so today's conversation is just going to be friends talking, sharing experiences. And the one topic that we ended up was sort of diversity 2.0. Mm-hmm. Like, we've been working with diversity for a long time, but how do we move from the traditional approach, which is what, please share reflections on sort of how you view that has been, but how do we go beyond that to the next, what's coming, and yeah, how do we push the boundaries of traditional approach to D&I?
Fantastic. Well, maybe if I could go first on that. I think when you look back at the sort of D&I strategies that a lot of businesses have had, frequently they're focused on individual characteristics. And there's lots of reasons why that's the case. I think that's absolutely right. I think that there is a need to start somewhere. And there's a big challenge, and maybe we'll talk about this a bit later, but a big challenge when it comes to what you can measure, what you're allowed to measure, what it's appropriate to measure. And typically that has been, for many organizations, started with gender and sex. And that is a starting point. But it's coming to a point now, I think, where lots of organizations have created programs, they've created schemes, they are looking at some of the structural barriers that stand in the way of women advancing within the workplace. And so progress, whilst I don't think any organization would say they're satisfied with progress made versus where we want to get to, but there is absolutely progress getting made. What I think about, though, when I look forward, is there's going to be a need to think more broadly. And we instead of focusing on diversity and effectively what it is that makes us different as the cornerstone of strategy, I think we really need to turn the lens and think much more about inclusion. And in particular, what is it that we have in common with each other? It touches on many themes of things like intersectionality, like who we are as individuals, referencing the conversation right at the beginning of this talk. And I think there's a lot we can do about focusing on the things we might have in common that you might not think initially is the case. So, for example, I like to think about visible diversity and non-visible diversity. And if you're not visibly diverse, you face quite a lot of similar challenges to other people who are not visibly diverse. And that could be your faith. It could be your home situation, whether you're a parent or a caregiver. It could be whether you're LGBTQ+. All of these individual groups have a lot in common around, when do I tell people about my thing? How do I constantly come out, or whatever the right phrase is for that? What does it feel like to be the person who's potentially carrying a secret in the room? And when's the right time to introduce that? And I think the more we focus on things like that, that are common and shared experiences around maybe a different diversity characteristic, the more we bridge gaps between the different groups. And then we're not spending our time talking about why you're different to me and why this group of people is different to that group of people and which one do I belong to or not belong to. But we're talking about a common and shared experience from which we can build a relationship.
Absolutely. And what I have to say is that I could not agree more with what you said, Will, because I feel like it's sort of like we are one person with just two different bodies, because I think not only in a professional setting, but I think really speaking, that's been my personal mantra as well. Having lived in sort of three continents, I think that's something that I've always felt and embodied, in the sense that at the end of the day, I think we are people. And to answer Danat's question, sort of, and to talk about this 2.0, of course, inclusion. And how do you make the mix of the visible and invisible diversity work is definitely the 2.0. So that's sort of the direct answer. But just to be a bit more provocative, I think it's always interesting to ask those of us, of you who are listening to us and then also here, is when did 1.0 end in the first place? I think what I'm trying to say is that it's definitely not a road of 1.0 that has ended and that we need to embark upon a 2.0. One of the things that I have learned working with this or being personally associated in working in diverse cultures, both trying to include people and including myself, and also working professionally and systematically with it. One of the things I have learned is that it's always the ambidexterity of two thoughts, which is that you have to have the visible and invisible diversity, and then you also have to make the inclusion part work. You have to have that belonging as well. So it's never been either or, I've always felt. But I completely agree, in the context of organizations, in the context of large companies, etc., you have to have a starting point. And of course, that has been very often through visible forms of diversity, and then it has progressed to other forms. And definitely moving forward, I think the world is becoming closer, but also in some ways, I think a much more complicated place when it comes to sort of visible diversity, because when you look at a person, you cannot tell what kind of experiences they've had, or how what kind of a mix of parents have they had, where have they lived. So I think it's definitely inclusion is the road forward, but it's going to be much more challenging than the 1.0.
I think one of the characteristics of 1.0, and I love, by the way, that we've created 1.0 and 2.0 today, and this is obviously now the way everyone's going to talk about it. Yep. But I think one of the characteristics has been that our approach to inclusion has been exclusive, in that if you focus on one particular group, whether that's based around gender identity or faith, ethnicity, whatever it might be, you're almost automatically creating a barrier that says to everybody else that this is our group. Now, I think there's an absolute need for those safe spaces. And I think we should be 100% celebrating the features of particular groups. That brings a richness to our culture. There's a lot that we can celebrate and shout about. But we have to acknowledge it also means that it creates some barriers. And if I think about, for example, LGBTQ plus inclusion, there's a lot of language there that can make it really difficult for people to engage with. Fear of saying the wrong thing, which is universal to different groups. If I, you know, I'm not educated enough and I don't use the right language, could I offend? And it's a real shame when that creates reticence or that creates a barrier to somebody having a conversation. You know, me personally, I'd much rather have a well-meaning conversation with someone with the right intention, but perhaps not the right language, than no conversation at all. And so this point around barriers, I think we need to break them down. And I think it's topics like allyship, helping people to understand, creating a safe space, psychological safety, where if I accidentally use the wrong word or the wrong pronoun or the wrong way of referring to somebody, that doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It means I'm somebody who needs to learn more, but is making an effort at least.
But taking it a bit back, just because we've talked a lot about now with diversity and inclusion, but what's the difference between two, or how do we differ the two, and are they different, and how?
So I'm sorry, I'm going to jump in on that one because I really love that question. That's fantastic. I think diversity is all about what makes us different and celebrating difference and having different thoughts, different views, different opinions, different looking people even. So it's all about those points of difference. Inclusion is almost the polar opposite. It's what brings us together. It's what creates an environment that welcomes anybody and everybody. And it's a really, really fascinating sort of relationship between the two, because we often put them together. In many ways, they're the opposite of one another. Yet at the same time, if you can get the two of them working in harmony, like yin and yang, brother and sister, then in actual fact, diversity and inclusion creates such a richness to both our culture, but also business benefit.
And I think, of course, couldn't agree more. One of the things, on a lighter note, what I've learned living in Norway is that short is good. So my definition is, of course, a bit more smaller, which is, of course, not much different. But I like to when I'm talking about it in different groups and leadership programs, etc. I just describe diversity as the mix, and inclusion is about making that mix work. So that's sort of is something that I've often seen is easy to remember and carry forward. So. Just like what Will said, that's sort of my translation of that into sort of two simple phrases. Diversity is about the mix, and inclusion is about making that mix work.
So if I follow up on that exactly, looking at the big organizations that both of you represent and work in and lead, yeah. I'm curious to know this: how do you get that mix working? And specifically, when you have so big systems where you have to put the fundaments in place for it to work, what are the challenges with getting that mix to work or not? And what are the sort of key aspects to someone perhaps listening that, you know, works in a similar situation?
So if I were to comment on that, you know, I've been pondering over that because that is, again, one of those questions that we discuss and in such settings quite a bit. And I would say that, first of all, if anybody thinks that it's going to be a bed of roses, then it definitely is not. So expect challenges. That's sort of the first thing. And I think then it's about a host of challenges. But one thing is for sure, is perhaps when, as we talk about, that in order to start working systematically with diversity, challenge will come, because there will be backlash, because the starting point in itself, as you said, Will, as well, is of exclusion and not of inclusion. So when you start with that point of being more exclusive towards a particular group in order to either make a bold move, make a statement, or have a starting point, make sure there will be challenges. And I think one of the first one is definitely you get a backlash because people don't understand. And the last thing I would just say, it eventually then comes down to, because all of us are human, and that's not always because somebody is opposing something else, but that's also just part of being human, is how we accept things. And that's classic change management theory as well. So we start with a lot of denial till we actually have acceptances. And I think, Will, you refer to measurement. So I definitely think to counter backlash or other challenges, which I'm not sort of listing right now, I'm sure you will mention those, is definitely to work with facts.
So for me, how do you make it work? I mean, it's challenging, but I do feel that we're, and society generally, I think, is moving towards an acceptance and willingness to do that. For me, I think you need a strategy that's a different strategy for diversity and a different strategy for inclusion. I think sticking them together sometimes actually doesn't work. And we've talked about the sort of sometimes how they're in opposition. But for diversity, it's all about highlighting the benefits, the business benefits that diversity can bring, whether that's better thinking, better understanding of each other. And there has to be an element of both celebration, so that people within diverse groups, however they are, feel valued, so that they feel that they're recognized, they're acknowledged, they're heard, they're listened to, the good and the bad about being a part of that group. So diversity is all about, a diversity strategy is all about highlighting some of that. And that's where some of this controversy can come about. But I think if we do that, you normalize the idea about talking about yourself and your differences. I think then when it comes to inclusion, that has to be much more focused on what are the things that, as I said before, what do we have in common? So a strategy around allyship. How do I make it easy for people to become allies? How do I create an environment where it's safe to ask questions about somebody else's lived experience? What's it like being a person like you in an organization like ours? Create that psychological safety for people to feel comfortable about doing that. It's about looking at the intersections around what we have in common. It's about bringing to get people together who wouldn't otherwise necessarily be in the room. And I think it's really important about engaging those groups who are traditionally the majority in inclusion, because a strategy based on diversity can leave certain people feeling, well, I've nothing to add to this. I'm embarrassed in case I say the wrong thing. So, and I'm the bad person. I'm the majority. I'm the one who's been repressing all of these other groups. But you can't successfully execute a strategy without everybody being a part of it. So engage those people in the inclusion strategy. Help them to become uncomfortable or become comfortable about being uncomfortable in situations where they have to talk about someone's lived experience that they might not have any experience of. Be prepared to listen to other people's stories, except you might not know everything, and be prepared to learn and educate yourselves. Things like that, I think all of these can really bring people together, regardless of background. So diversity is your left hand, inclusion is your right hand, and get the two of them really working together. And I think that's where 2.0 really sits.
And I think if I can just add something on that, as you ask about challenges, and I think it's also important to remember that when you're faced with challenges, when you're working with your diversity strategy, remember that it's not a sprint, it's a journey. Because working systematically with diversity and inclusion, or you can say it the other way around as well, but let's suppose that diversity is this kind of a starting point as we've been talking about it. I truly believe that when you start off, very often we start off with some type of a sprint because it makes some kind of a mark. And that's where we end up getting a lot of challenges, end up getting a lot of backlash. So it's very important to understand that you can start off as a sprint, but remember, it is going to be a marathon. It is going to be a journey. So there are going to be ups and downs, and the challenges that you will get, like we were talking about earlier, will only lead to more positive outcomes in the longer run.
I also think you need to start small and grow from there. So one of the things that we have, which I think we're very proud of, is we have a huge number of really incredibly high quality assets, if you like, that are there to support and help our people to learn about lived experiences. So it's things like training, we have language guides, we have easy to digest information for people, so that if you're working with somebody who is in this particular group, here are the things to be aware of. Here's sort of a bit of guidance around the language to use, which is fantastic. You cannot expect any one of our busy professionals to read through all of that material. And so you have to make it easy for them. And it starts with, I think, when you have personal experience. So when one of your team members has an issue or comes to you with something that relates to a particular characteristic that you're not familiar with, knowing where those resources are, being able to use them, bring them out in a conversation, or even just knowing how to deal with that conversation and committing to educating yourself more, it starts with those small steps with the individual. And that then has a ripple effect, in my view, across the whole of the organization. That's when the marathon sort of really gets run, because you then create an environment for people to bring other elements of themselves to work. And over time, that culture moves forward. Culture change management being one of the hardest things to achieve in any organization.
But I love that fact, because I want to dive into that. Because how do you then get a culture where everyone feels responsible for making people feel included, making people feel that, you know, it's not the D&I department that's going to fix this whole issue, you know? How do we get champions throughout the organizations to feel like this is also my responsibility? How do we get people caring that's maybe not the person that, you know, very often minority people that belongs to the diversity group feels that, you know, I need to conform into or be part of the majority culture instead of the other way around. So I don't know, what are your reflections on that?
If I were to go, I have three things for that. One is, first of all, leadership has to walk the talk. If you're talking about it, if you really mean it, then the leadership of the organization has to walk the talk. The second point I have is that I think you have to make it easy for everyone to absorb and internalize if you want to really make it part of our culture, of your culture. So for instance, in Telenor, one of the ways we express our organizational cultures is through four of the behaviors. And at least two of those refer to making the mix, talking about the mix, diversity, which and that phrase is called creating together. How can we create together? And the other behavior we have is being respectful. And that very much, at least we internalize that as to talking about how can we respect different point of views and include people and make sure that we have the psychological safety to discuss. So first, it's about leadership walking the talk. Second, it's about making it easy. And third, and I think third is a bit difficult, and I think we can all hear a lot of debates around in different environments. I think even the minority groups, then you need to enable the minority groups, but I believe that's a dual responsibility. They need to try and include themselves, as the organization should make an honest effort as well. And I just want to share a sort of a personal example with that. Mm. So, of course, my first language is English. Pretty much that's what I've studied. I've studied through a British education system, and then I've lived in the United States. So I pretty much dream in English, even though I have another native language. But the point is that when it was about learning Norwegian, for me, it wasn't only about being able to talk to others, or understand others, but I think consciously that was my effort from my end to include others and at the same time include myself, so that when you are faced with a majority as a minority, I myself putting something out there to make an effort. So those are my three things. Leadership walk the talk, has to walk the talk. You have to make it easy in order to make it part of your organizational culture. And the third is that consciously include minority groups, but the minority groups need to also make an effort to include themselves.
But I was wondering, you know, obviously we care about this because we have a personal passion for this. But what about the people that doesn't care, or for the people that doesn't, where this topic doesn't come natural to, right? To think about how do we get them to, in their work, think about this? And that's one aspect of it. But also you talked about it starts with the leaders. What about the leaders that doesn't care? How do we get this into their, to where it, and I'm saying where it hurts, but you know, where in their scorecards, or how do we get them caring, the ones that naturally don't care, either if it's not part of their awareness or how they think? Because there's definitely a need for an upskilling. But what are your reflections on that topic? Do we need to get everyone to care?
Personally, I think absolutely we do need to get everybody to care. And I think, like many things, it's really, as we've said, very hard to measure. It's really hard to measure good quality leadership as a whole, actually, I find. I think many organizations are perfectly adequately good when it comes to bad behavior and the consequences arising from people who are bad leaders, do something wrong, you know, the disciplinary type processes, they tend to work. What is much, much harder is rewarding good leadership, whether that is through building and creating diverse teams and opportunities for diverse people, or whether that is just showing the characteristics of good leadership. Again, because when you put that on a scorecard next to financial performance or other much more traditional metrics, there's no way of comparing the two. So I think, yes, we do need people to care. How do you do that? I think you have to demonstrate and raise up and praise and make examples around people who are good at this, whether they have helped individuals. There's a lot of storytelling involved, I think, in terms of how they've created a culture within their group or in their team, raising up those examples so that it becomes the norm. I think creating environments where people can feel safe to explore the limits of their understanding without recrimination is important. But I think it's a much longer and slower process than it would be for something like a financial metric, which you can, you know, measure month in, month out and assess progress.
Yes. And I think it's very much, if there is one thing I have to say that perhaps could be the ultimate solution, at least in my view, of course, there are many. And I think that is about giving people the experience of experiencing exclusion as well as inclusion. And I think that kind of a learning, and if you're able to reflect on that kind of an experience, that perhaps is the biggest way for a leader, for an individual, whether you're in a majority group, whether you're in a minority group, to internalize it. For a minority group, what is it like when you have the psychological safety, when you do feel included? What is that nirvana? And similarly, for a majority group, and again, within that majority, there could be many, many minorities, as we talked about intersectionality. But the point is, for a majority group, seemingly majority group, if they experience exclusion, that's the best way of internalizing it. And we could do this through leadership training programs, and you could engage into really good conversations around it, really open conversations. But there are also various methods and tools as well where you can actually bring out and have an open discussion about people's biases. And only when you have that kind of an open dialogue, that's when you actually learn and create a safe space to even tell people that it's okay to share what your bias is, because the very fact is people who are actually talking about it very often are going to be conscious about it. And so, I mean, just in terms of sort of two resources, if I were to mention, I mean, it's something that everybody can look up online, and perhaps many people who are listening to this already know about it. There is a website called the Implicit Association Test, created by Harvard University and some of the collaboration of other universities. There are various different types of tests, and while there could be many views around it, but at least in a leadership training program, for instance, that leads to very interesting conversations. We had one individual, for instance, talked about how he was biased against people who were more overweight, for instance. And at the same time, it creates sometimes more serious conversations as well. So I think that's sort of one resource. And I would say the second one, I would say as one of the biggest conversations these days is around artificial intelligence. I think there's lots of tools coming up to actually talk about and see what your biases are. For instance, as an example, there is one tool that actually, no matter what you write, it actually gives you an inclusion score broken down into 5 different components. So no matter what is it, whatever it is that you're writing, it'll tell you an inclusion score on 5 different dimensions. And so actually we have various sort of ways and tools to actually help us become more inclusive and actually really give people the experience of inclusion and exclusion.
And that's a brilliant example there. And the conversation on bias is really interesting and really important as well, actually. For me, what makes it difficult is we know sort of intellectually that we all have biases. We are all biased towards people who are similar to ourselves in whichever way you want to define that. And that means that when you sort of face up to the idea of bias, but it also comes with this big sort of bucket of shame in terms of it's like you're a bad person for having biases, or that you're somehow making bad decisions and being the one who's holding back others because of your own biases. And I think we've got a ways to go before people naturally, and I would include myself in this, sort of can get really comfortable with the idea that I just have biases because of who I am and where I was brought up. And we've all been brought up in a different way. And we have to strike that balance between creating an environment where people can just acknowledge that. You don't have to share it. I don't have to go through do the test, which I've seen is fantastic. I don't have to share it with everybody what my biases are, no. But I have to know what they are myself and be prepared to challenge myself if, as I'm making decisions around, and it's not the big decisions necessarily, it's a lot of the small decisions. But if I know I'm naturally inclined to favour people who are from a similar socioeconomic background to me, or similar ethnicity, or in the same country even, then at least going into a decision armed with that information, it's then my responsibility to do something about it. But when we talk about it in an organisational context, it's this shame that really, you know, and the fear that, am I going to be revealed to be something ist, if you like, because I have natural biases. So we've got to get over that.
And there's a balance there, but I think the example that you draw, Umair, with the importance of experience. I had an example from a client project where they were working on how can we include more people in the uses of our cases and in our products and services. So it's in mobility services. So they actually, one big minority group that's left outside is people with disabilities, right? Mm. So you actually got a leadership group to sit in a wheelchair for a whole day and use the mobility services that are available, which I believe, and I think, left a lot of the leadership group with a different way of actually how does this work and understanding. And we probably could have come in and just talked about it in a keynote for them, but actually getting them out there, trying it themselves and experiencing on their bodies made a different total impression, and a way more powerful one, I would assume, than just getting that talk. And yeah,
So it's really interesting. So lived experience, and how would a diversity and equity inclusion strategy use lived experience? I think, again, if we go back to 1.0, I think that lots of organizations relied on their own people who had lived experience to be the experts in all things relating to that particular characteristic, whether that was asking them to review policies, to review suppliers' codes of conduct and things like that. And these are people who might have nothing to do with that particular area of expertise. So I think there's a really important angle here around what is the right role of the people with lived experience? Also, you don't want to lean on them too much. You can't expect them, just because they belong to a certain group, to have some kind of responsibility for your, you know, organizational strategy or where you're going with DE&I. But at the same time, they can be incredibly powerful when it comes to road testing or understanding how the policies or the approaches or the initiatives that you try, how they come across to somebody who has lived experience. But finding the right role for that experience within your strategy is quite important. You certainly don't want individuals to feel that they are somehow becoming the single spokesperson for an entire population, because even if you have a particular characteristic, you can only ever speak to your experience of being that thing or living with that characteristic. So finding the right way for it and not expecting it of people is also incredibly important.
And as Will talked about 1.0, then this time I will go on to the 2.0. And I think with having an experienced inclusion, exclusion, and internalizing it, in my viewpoint, I think the biggest benefit of that is the way you engage people or include people, which is sort of the 2.0 we're talking about. When it comes into your leadership repertoire, I believe it's then becomes a form of art, how you exercise that leadership, how you exercise inclusion, how you engage people. And I believe the reason it's so important is because having that experience, you just know how to do one single thing, which at least I started off giving some views at the start of this podcast, which is that at the very core of it, we're all human. And I think there are always some basic aspects that when you sort of have an experience yourself, that you're able to treat people at least on the level of what is basic to us as all as human. And that's sort of what unites us as well. So that's sort of my view and take on that.
I love that. I think 2.0 is based on diversity, equity, and inclusion through the lens of human rights that we all share. We're all human. We all have human rights. I think that is a much more solid foundation for thinking about these things than lived experience, what's the differences, and all the rest of the things we've talked about. The other thing that this sort of touches on as well, when you think about lived experience, is the importance of role models. And I think that's really quite double-edged. I think definitely people in an organization want to see people with whom they can identify in whatever way that might be being successful in the organization. It tells a very visible signal of you can make it too. There are people like you in successful roles. But it also comes with a health warning, because the way in which one particular person has chosen to structure their life to get to wherever they are isn't necessarily the way that everybody needs to do that. So I my personal view is we need role models, but we need role models who are intersectional, i.e. these are role models who acknowledge, yes, I am this thing, but I've also got all these other elements to me. And the way I've chosen to get to this point is my way of doing things. Other people can do it in the same way. So you want those role models, but you don't want to reduce them to just the one characteristic that is being promoted. And so I think, again, it's partly down to culture. I think role models have an important role to play in that, but don't place that right at the heart of your strategy, because it's not going to solve it in itself.
So with that being said, then, if we're going towards the end here, and we've started this with, diversity 1.0 and now 2.0, if you were to push the boundaries to the very limit, right, moving forward in terms of what's next, what's coming, moving from the traditional approach, what would be your concrete call to action, ask or wish? How would you see it? Like, where are we going then, if you would get your wish?
So I think firstly, I think we're already talking about the 3.0. And I think that's the that's the beauty of sort of three people coming from three very different backgrounds in some ways. And I just want to sort of summarize it in one way, at least where we stand today. I think the 3.0 is kind of where Will ended. And to me, it is about, it would be about, if we could look at the intersectionality of all of us, and we're able to say that beyond the lens of diversity, beyond sort of including, if you could then start looking at sort of all of us as human, but recognizing that I am more than what you see or feel.
I love that.
And I think that would be an interesting place for a 3.0. But at the same time, an equally challenging one. So I don't even want to think about the measurement of it.
Can I just ask or follow? I just have to follow up on that, and then you can end well. But what does that then mean in a business context, for example? How do you translate that as a business leader, leading an organization or leading a department or leading people, or the other way around, being part of an organization? How does that work?
I think what I'm talking about is continuing that journey, right, that we started. And again, none of the other 1.0s and 2.0s are going to end. But let's just assume it's a sequential thing, and you've gone over the 1.0, and you can make the mix of diversity work, and you've gone through the hypothetically 2.0, and you have the art of inclusion sorted. Then I think the 3.0 is about perhaps a state where you truly recognize that it does not matter who is in front of me, what color, what skin, what profession, where they're coming from. It's truly about what that individual brings to the table. And that's what creates value for the business, for the customers, and for the stakeholders.
I think this is brilliant. I really do. This is really, really fascinating. So for me, 3.0 is reducing it all down to the one thing. There's one thing that we all have in common, and that's that we're human. And I think that is that is truly inclusion nirvana, if you like, where we all recognize that we're all the same because we're human and everything else is just exciting and different and things that we should be exploring and celebrating. But none of it matters because ultimately we're humans with rights and that's how we interact and engage with one another. Now, that utopia, I feel maybe some way away. And obviously there's a lot to do still within what we're calling 2.0. The other element to me in terms of in a business context and, you know, what would I guess success look like? I really think the culture of an organization is where all of this change happens, where you and it's not easy, but where you get a culture of acceptance, of openness, of psychological safety, of basically creating the greenhouse, the right conditions for conversations and interactions around diversity and inclusion to happen. I think if you can create that, not saying it's easy, but if you can create that, that's when the tallest plants will grow and you'll really reap the benefits.
Thank you so much. So in this conversation, we went from diversity 1.0 to actually 3.0. So, I can reckon and really like with that's the utopia that we want to go to, but also acknowledge that there is a lot of work and it's also a maturity journey that we have to go through. So thank you so much for joining me in the studio and sharing your experiences and reflections. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening in and continue to follow us on Spotify, Facebook, Instagram, and all the media there is.